Just a few days after last week's fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the coalition military death toll reached 4,000. The war has divided America. The invasion and the occupation also divided the Bush administration. And that's the subject of Bush's War, the new two-part PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight and tomorrow night. My guest is the producer, Michael Kirk. He's produced several Frontline documentaries about the Bush administration and the war in Iraq, including The Lost Year in Iraq, Rumsfeld's War, The Dark Side, and Gunning for Saddam. The new documentary, Bush's War, includes material from previous Frontline editions as well as new interviews. The documentary is titled Bush's War, but in a way, Bush isn't even one of the main characters in the documentary. The main characters are more like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell and Condoleezza Rice, Tenet. Do you really see it as Bush's War? Do you see it as other people's war and Bush goes along for the ride?
Certainly, you know, as we were making all of these films, we kept saying to ourselves, and people would often say to us when they saw one of the films, where's the president? And in a way, he wasn't really engaged. Everybody we've talked to about this says until the spring, really, of 2006, the president was a much more passive player in the war in Iraq than many people would believe or expect. But he is, after all, the president. And so he does, you know, in lots of ways, he dictated fine-grained parts of the decisions. And he was also the object of everyone's attention. They, you know, were battling for access to him, not so much because of whatever he would decide, but because it gave them a leg up on their opponent. If you're Rumsfeld, you want to have implied to Powell that you've been seeing a lot more of the president than he has, for example.
Now, your documentary shows that right from the start, there was conflict between Tenet and his CIA and Rumsfeld and his Defense Department over who was running the show. What was the first conflict between them after September 11th?
Well, it became fairly clear that the Defense Department was not in any way prepared. There were no plans, for example, to go to war in Afghanistan. It is a place that all militaries around the world, especially the United States military, remember as the place that took the Soviet Union down. Nobody wanted to think very seriously about ever going anywhere near Afghanistan. But the CIA had a plan. They had an ongoing kind of idea about a way to take places like Afghanistan, if ever there were the war on terror, that they kept believing was going to eventuate. So from the very beginning, the first argument is between the big, heavy military and Rumsfeld within the Defense Department and Rumsfeld and George Tenet. In other words, the Central Intelligence Agency wanted small, light, nimble attack forces that they would go in and do things covertly. The heavy United States military, the Army especially, said, no, it's going to take 7 months and hundreds of thousands of people, and we want to do it with strategic bombing, et cetera, the usual game plan. And Rumsfeld himself, who was as head of Secretary of Defense and in an ongoing battle with the military to transform the way they fought, wanted something in between what the CIA had and the military wanted. So there were really three forces at bay in those early days about what to do about Afghanistan, and the CIA eventually won.
So the CIA goes in first, and the way you describe it in the documentary Bush's War, the CIA does its covert work in Afghanistan, and then it's ready for the military to come in. But the military doesn't come in yet. The CIA waits for nearly a month for the military to come in. Why?
Well, you know, the way that everybody tells us the story, Rumsfeld was very upset about the fact that he was going to have to follow the lead of the Central Intelligence Agency of all places, that he would have to be second to George Tenet of all people. And that essentially what Rumsfeld did was hold everything kind of in the background while the CIA waited for him to come forward with the troops, the special forces that would be necessary to execute the phase of the CIA's plan that would swing the Northern Alliance into action against the Taliban. They waited for 30 days up in the the valleys, some of the CIA agents waiting for Rumsfeld to come in, to order his guys to come in. And it isn't until a National Security Council meeting that Richard Armitage in our film talks about in the first person, where he says to the president, "I think things are foobar." The president is wondering, why isn't anything happening in Afghanistan? If you'll recall, the press was reporting quagmire. In the end, of course, the president chooses Don Rumsfeld to be in charge. And as soon as he gives Rumsfeld the lead, the forces begin to arrive, and Kabul falls 3 days later.
So what did we lose? Did we lose something during that period when the military wasn't going in? And the way you describe it, it's as if Rumsfeld was holding them up until he got control, until he was given the power.
It may not be so much that we lost anything. It's the potential for what could have happened. And, of course, who knows how different the war on terror would be if the CIA had been given their head to lead what is an asymmetrical war, after all. I know they believe, when you talk to Central Intelligence Agency officers at the highest level, they all believe in that they were ready to fight kind of across the board, across the map, 80 different countries, all kinds of efforts that they were ready to go with, and especially once they'd been given the legal authority to go to the dark side. They really believed that they could eradicate, or at least go after and seriously diminish Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations that they were watching for. The nature of the conflict, of course, would change dramatically.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Kirk, and he's produced many frontline documentaries on the war in Iraq, and his latest is a two-part program called Bush's War that airs tonight and tomorrow night on most public television stations. Now, this documentary goes over a lot of the conflicts in the Bush administration, and it goes into how Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State, was shut out of some of the major decision-making. For instance, he was shut out on the decisions to set up military tribunals, to dispense with the Geneva Conventions, to do extreme interrogation techniques. Why was he shut out, and who shut him out?
I think it's pretty clear in the film. We kind of went back in history a little bit to figure out what was at the heart of the disagreement between Rumsfeld primarily and Colin Powell. As you know, the State Department and the Defense Department across many administrations have always been slightly at odds. But this is unusual, and this is also personal in the sense that the two individuals, Rumsfeld and Powell, don't really seem to like each other. And the vice president, who's had a longstanding, obviously, relationship, 40-year political friendship and alliance with Don Rumsfeld, also doesn't seem to like Powell very much. We date the actual moment when it happens as the very first day of the Bush administration back in December, after the Florida decision had been handed down by the Supreme Court, and the president of the United States names Colin Powell in a kind of healing gesture as Secretary of State. Powell gives a very expansive press conference. In that press conference, he kind of veers, as former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, kind of veers between military and diplomatic, and it seems like what he's, or it appears to certainly the vice president and other conservative supporters of the president, that really what this moderate Colin Powell is doing is acting like both Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, and of course they can't brook that. And Don Rumsfeld is brought on to be the sort of anti-Powell force inside the administration, and he becomes that. And they go at it for 9 months before the months right before 9/11. And of course, after 9/11, their worldviews become very apparent, and all the things that follow for Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld.
Now, Condoleezza Rice was shut out of a lot of decision-making, too, when she was the National Security Advisor. And Elizabeth Buemiller, in your documentary, who's a New York Times reporter who wrote a recent book about Condoleezza Rice, tells an incredible story about the extreme that Rice sometimes had to go through to get information. Would you tell the story she tells?
Yes, it's completely astonishing when you think about it, that the National Security Advisor of the United States and a person who had a personal friendship with the President of the United States actually had so little power in the run-up to the war, partly because she was surrounded by what one person in our film calls the elephants in the room, very big, powerful men like Colin Powell and Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Rumsfeld treated her, Elizabeth says in the film, like a graduate student, a Russian studies graduate student. He was very secretive anyway, always holding very close all of the information about troop plans and ideas for how they were going to do what they were going to do in Iraq. But she felt by necessity that she needed to know some things. But Rumsfeld rarely spoke directly to her in most meetings, and she couldn't gather the information. So what she, what Elizabeth Buehmiller tells us is that what Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor of the United States of America and a close personal friend of the president, had to do to get troop information from the Secretary of Defense was one of the members of the National Security Council staff would put on a uniform, a military uniform, and go over to the Pentagon and access information based as on their in their role as a military member, not as a member of Rice's staff. That's that I think to almost anybody who hears it and knows how the inner circle works. Finds it just astonishing that such a thing would eventuate.
My guest is Michael Kirk, and he's produced many frontline documentaries on the war in Iraq, and his latest, Bush's War, is a two-part program that airs tonight and tomorrow night on most PBS stations. The documentary looks at a lot of conflicts within the Bush administration in the lead-up to the war and after regime change in Iraq. It also looks at some of the conflicts between President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair. And you have a new interview in there with the man who was then the ambassador from England to the United States. And he tells you an interesting story about the deal between President Bush and Tony Blair. Would you tell what that deal was?
Yes, right after 9/11, literally the day after 9/11, in England, you know, Tony Blair doesn't know George Bush very well, certainly is uneasy about what might happen. They're afraid, as Ambassador Meyer tells us, they're afraid of some cowboy action by the unknown and freshly minted American president, that they'll that maybe has a hair trigger, that maybe something untoward will happen in the Middle East or somewhere else, maybe even in a European capital. They don't really know what he's going to do. And so Blair's task from the onset is to get to the new president and find out, is he, and be assured by the new president that the, that America will move carefully in the direction of al-Qaeda and no place else. He comes to the president, talks to the president, and is assured that everything will be all right. He comes to Washington worried because there have been noises from almost the very beginning that America is aiming for Iraq ultimately. He's worried about that, Blair. He comes to Bush and says, I'm really worried about this. The president assures him that Afghanistan and the Taliban and al-Qaeda are job one for the United States, and anything that follows in the future is still not been decided. It makes Blair feel pretty sure that everything's going to be okay. But Blair is very, very interested throughout this time in making sure that the United States goes to the United Nations and cuts the rest of the world in, especially Europe, into the decision, that the president, Blair, is an ally of Secretary of State Powell's. And they're very interested in making sure that a broad-based coalition supports any effort that happens in the war on terror. And the president assures him that in the end that he will go to the United Nations and seek a resolution. But in return, he wants Blair to promise him that if the United States exhausts the process at the United Nations, he Blair, will support them if they decide to go to war no matter what. And Blair, realizing the implications of this, I think, still agrees to do it. And in the end, according to Chris Meyer, his ambassador and others in his government, gives away Britain's leverage at exactly that moment, much to their chagrin.
You've done so many investigations into the war in Iraq, what happened behind the scenes. What do you still want to know?
Oh, that's a great question. I want to know why and how a group of people working together, maybe even with really good intentions, found themselves not wanting to know, not wanting to brook any outside opinion. How is it that you can function at such a high and important level and want to exclude all the forces that are designed and built into the system to act as a brake on policymakers who want to go forward based on information and intelligence, but shouldn't? How did that happen? And the second level is how personality, just how those personalities could so impact policy. What is it about the dynamic between, as I call them, these big Shakespearean characters has taken place that caused them to go the way they went here and there? And finally, why didn't Colin Powell resign? Why didn't George
in protest, you mean, resign in
yes.
protest instead of being pushed
yes.
out?
Exactly. At the moment that if they really felt as strongly as their surrogates tell us they felt, why didn't they go when they could have had an impact on closing something down? That is always fascinating to me about policymakers.
Do you ever wonder if President Bush ever has second thoughts about the war?
It is a question I ask everybody who knows him fairly well and the people who've been in meetings with him, and they always say that he's a man who makes up his mind fairly quickly, and when he does, he thinks it's wrong to change it. So that it somehow shows a kind of weakness. And that is fascinating to me because it means that I think there's a kind of certainty there that seems to be part of the hard wiring of the president that has manifested itself in what has happened in Iraq and the Middle East.
Michael Kirk, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Michael Kirk produced the two-part Frontline documentary, Bush's War. It airs tonight and tomorrow night. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.